in this technical track by Jeremy Allison from the Zumba team and Google about the Zumba engineering process. Looks like you've changed it a little to development process.
Okay. Was it Zumba engineering? Oh. Anyway, yes. I must correct our host at one point. I'm not actually speaking on behalf of Google, and they would probably scream, and you know, lawyers would dive in through the walls and the windows if they knew I was speaking on their behalf. So please don't take anything I say as anything to do with Google. I am, in fact, speaking almost solely on behalf of the Zumba team, even though Google sponsors the conference. So I'm standing between everybody and finishing the conference. So this is not going to be a terribly technical talk. It'll be a nice, you know, sort of fluffy how we got here. And hopefully if I do this right, it will turn into a, you know, vicious bitching session between members of the Zumba team about about, you know, why we do things and why we do them wrong and stuff like that. But I'm hoping that for other people, it might give a little bit of an insight into why we are as dysfunctional as we are, and why things amazingly work as well as they do, but sometimes don't work well at all, and how we got to this point. So to go back in time, in the beginning was the FTP site. Does anyone actually remember that address? Did anyone actually ever, other than me, did anyone actually connect to? So there's only the three of us in the room. That's John, Volker, and myself. This was actually Andrew Tridgell, who is the original creator of Zumba and aptly dubbed the smartest man in Australia. A man who gave up working on gravity wave physics research to write code is smarter than most of us, I think. Anyway, so this was his personal machine at the university, and he was a procrastinating student, and so started to write code instead, like many of us do, Kai. Because it's much easier than trying to finish a PhD. So in the beginning, Andrew essentially just put tarballs of Zumba up on his FTP site, and you would download them, and if you wanted to make changes, you would make the changes locally. And if you were community-minded enough and you wanted to send fixes back, you would just use the patch and diff, you would use the diff command, mail it to him, he would apply it as a patch, and literally sometimes 10, 20 minutes later, a new version will be up on the FTP site for everybody to use. So QA was originally not a massive concern, as our Lord and Master Chairman Linus. I have to use a Linus quote because I just like that picture. But that was really the attitude. If it compiles, it's good. You know, if it boots up, or in the case of Zumba, if it doesn't immediately crash, then it's obviously perfect. Because at that point, you have to remember the target audience were not the kind of users that we see using Zumba today, or indeed corporations. Zumba was for system administrators who needed that code to get their day-to-day job done. I mean, my day-to-day job was actually writing Windows code on the recently released Windows NT 3.1, and I needed a source code control system that ran across the network. PCNFS just didn't work and still doesn't work. And so making Zumba work was the only way I was going to get my job done. So working on this code essentially was the code was for really only for people who could compile it, who knew what a compiler was, who knew what a debugger was, who could actually modify and fix the code themselves. So QA at that point isn't a great concern, because if it crashes, then, you know, hey, you fix it. You notice the crash, it's probably your fault. So we went along for a long while like that. And how many people here actually started their own open source projects? Not too many, I guess. I'm used to speaking to more of a developer's audience. But in many ways, when you are a single developer and you're trying to get traction on a project, you really shouldn't worry that much about QA. You're not trying to produce something that is completely polished. You're trying to produce something that's useful. If it crashes a lot, yes, that's awful and people will hate you for it, but it's what's a lot worse is not having functions and functionality in the code. So it's very important to rapidly iterate and get the code out there and have people work on it. Quality can come later. I know that seems, you know, counterproductive, especially these days, but it's actually true when you're starting a small project, which is what Samba was in those days. So the first sign that, you know, Samba was becoming known was, of course, via a lawyer who contacted Tridge and basically, very, very politely, I must confess, told him that SMB server, which was what the code was called at the time, actually violated a trademark of Syntax Corporation out of Seattle. And, you know, they were very nice. They requested a name change. Does anyone know how the name Samba came about? Samba team members need not apply. Thank you. Anyone? Anyone else? Okay, so... Well, all right, but I'm going to tell the story because I'm on stage and you're not. So after being told that we couldn't use the name SMB server anymore, in the grand Unix tradition, Tridge actually took the letters S, M, and B and did a grep in UserDict words, the dictionary, to find out what words might match for SMB. And apparently the only two matching words were Samba and Salmonberry. So we decided that to become the Samba project rather than the Salmonberry project. But it's interesting because having a decent name actually does matter in terms of creating a community and getting people to contribute. One of the reasons I feel that poor Jim of the Linux Foundation failed miserably with their embedded Linux distribution is because it got saddled with the completely stupid name of Migo. So when you have a name as bad as that, nobody wants to contribute because it just sounds stupid. And so SMB server is functional but boring, but Samba's kind of cool. And in fact, many years later when TotalNet Advanced Server had gone out of business because we'd rolled over them, the lawyer, many years later, ran into Tridge at a conference and said, you know, I kind of wish we hadn't sent that letter because Sam was a much better name and we should probably have used it. And of course, you get the t-shirts, the marketing, and even the conference merchandising possibilities around a decent name. So originally Samba, oh, question?
Yeah, I just want to comment on the name Samba. Having published how Tridge got to that name,
yeah,
resulted in a lot of as uppercase S, lowercase A, uppercase M, uppercase B,
ah.
Uppercase A, even though we within the team have never used that.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. So originally Samba was published under a no commercial use license. This was actually, I never saw that version of the code. This was before it became really popular. So a guy called Dan Shearer, who's I think more associated with Julian and OpenChange these days, he contacted Tridge and basically showed him the GPL and Linux and kind of opened his eyes and said, no, this no commercial use thing isn't going to fly. You need free software is where it's at. You need to change. And you know there are many opinions these days on whether BSD is the correct license or Apache or GPL. And, you know, and the fashions change over the years. But I actually believe that, especially in the environment that Samba found itself in the beginning, which was many proprietary vendors refusing to share code and information on how the protocol worked, the GPL was actually very valuable for us because it helped create a sense of community around people wanting to contribute. And essentially, we couldn't have any secrets. Everybody had to share. So it's interesting to contrast that to the start of the Apache project, which also had a cool name, started around the same time. And they chose a completely permissive license. But one of the reasons for that, I think, and why they were so successful with that, is that they were in a world where they were creating the market themselves. They weren't in a place where there was already a very dominant vendors, you know, who we were trying to interoperate with. They were literally out there blazing new ground and creating a new protocol and creating the web, essentially. They did rather better than we did, of course, but I don't think licensing had much to do with that. But I do think the licensing was pretty important, and I'll mention about how we ended up with the GPLv3 a little later. So who owns Samba? Interestingly enough, one of the original PCNFS vendors, again, another time I realized that we were actually doing quite well with Samba was when one of the PCNFS vendors, after spending much marketing muscle in the press and sort of, you know, releases talking about how awful this free software stuff was and people would be much better off with PCNFS, invited Tridge to come and visit them in Santa Clara and then offered him $45 million for the project. So, which he said he was a little ashamed to have to tell them that he couldn't accept the money because he didn't own it. And that's because Tridge and Samba, we've always accepted patches from everyone. And at the time, we didn't even consider the copyright ownership. I mean, to be honest, I was essentially stealing time from my employer to write this stuff. And there was no, you know, there was no agreements that I had with them about what they owned and what I owned. They were just happy that they were getting working file serving. And so many people were working on code under the radar. Now, of course, free software has become somewhat bigger business. There are many agreements around who owns copyright, how it's assigned. But the nice thing is, by the time we became very widely used, our ownership was so smeared out that it was complete, like Linux, it was completely impossible for anyone to take it proprietary or assert any reasonable ownership rights over it. This did give us a few problems later on, which I'll go into. But again, it was a great way to build community and make it feel like it was owned by everyone and that no one had a more special stake in it than anyone else, which is very important when you're creating a development community. So originally, as I said, Tridge just took tarballs and dumped them on the FTP site. It was around Samba 1.7 in 94, which is actually amazingly late when you think about it, that he actually thought, you know, I really need to do a little more QA around the release process than just pushing my, you know, source of the day up onto the FTP site. And so he actually started writing a script that, you know, would aptly call release Samba. And it just essentially made sure that the make files were there, everything had the correct permissions, you know, everything was copied there. There was some, at least some basic man pages, and that everything that people downloaded would actually be in a workable, a usable state. I inherited the release management, I think around 1.9, when he got fed up of doing it. And I started to add, you know, this is usually the way things go. I started to add more steps to it. And by this time, we were becoming a lot bigger. There was a lot more people depending on it. I'd already heard that there were various banks using the software. And so it's funny, by the end of my time as release manager, when I handed over to Jerry Carter, I literally used to have panic attacks the night before a release. Oh, sorry, Carolyn. Yeah, I feel someone else may have similar feelings. The night before a release, I would have panic attacks, and I couldn't sleep, and I would obsessively go through the steps just to make sure everything was in place, the permissions were correct. You know, I would start building it on various platforms and just doing basic tests just to make sure the damn thing actually ran and didn't immediately crash and we weren't going to be completely humiliated by shipping non-working code. And as I can see, this has continued to this day. So amazingly enough, we managed without source code control, much like the Linux kernel sort of lives in Linus's tree, or did for the longest time, until about 1996, when we first moved to the stunningly advanced CVS. But having used proprietary source code control systems, actually it was stunningly advanced. So the interesting thing is, many people say about open source, well, how can you trust it? Anyone can put stuff in there. But that's never really true. The source code is always controlled. At least in the case of Samba, it was always controlled by Tridge. So long as his machine was never compromised, which it never was, to our knowledge, you know, the source code was always good. And once we had a central source code repository, this is when things started to change development-wise, because having a source code repository changes you. It allows, so at that point, Tridge could relax. He wasn't the person who, if he went on vacation for a week, you know, Samba development would stop and his patch queue would fill up in his mail. You know, people who he trusted could be given the permissions to actually check in code remotely, and you could check out different branches. You know, we had the ability to create different branches for different purposes, and people could have their own branch work on different features. And essentially, the workflow that we established when we first moved to CVS is pretty close to the workflow we still use today, Git notwithstanding. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And the other big change that having source code control meant, it really was the genesis of the idea of the Samba team, as in the group of developers who collectively are tasked with creating and maintaining Samba. So it was actually John who I think created the initial idea of the team, but it was built around people who had direct commit access into the source code repository and were essentially trusted not to screw it up, even though many of us did very often. You know, the idea was that we were privileged because we had the rights to commit directly into the code base that so many people depended on for so many things. And the idea was that, you know, if somebody broke the build, and this is still a technique used inside corporations to this day, essentially, you are publicly ashamed if you break the build. You know, your name is known out there. Unfortunately, we had a few developers who should remain nameless, they're no longer with us, who really didn't care if they broke the build. and so that was somewhat hard to deal with. I'm not going to mention any names, but essentially this set the idea that Samba team membership was something that you could work towards. It gave people a goal to achieve, and when you're a volunteer project who can't pay any wages, who can't pay out any dividends or you know give any prizes, you know, sort of being able to say yes, you're trusted enough to have direct commit access to the repository is a very valuable, it's really the only currency you have to pay people in. If you worked hard, you're good enough, you know, you get to be on the team and commit patches directly. And, you know, Tridge's real motivation behind it was he really didn't want to have to merge large patches that may have diverged from what he had in his current source code repository at the time. For the longest time, does anyone remember the days of having a makefile that you edited with a text editor before we did anything? Anyone remember that? So again, it's the, kind of the older developers. So for people people who haven't run across that, most software when distributed as source before AutoTools, you would have a makefile, and sometimes it was called, you know, makefile.sample or something, so that you knew not to make from it. And what it would have is, hopefully if it was well-structured, was a series of comments saying, you know, for SunOS, uncomment these lines, for Linux, uncomment these lines, for BSD, do this, you know, for OSF1, do that. And so you would select the version of the system that you wanted to build, and then you would type make from that. What that does to your development is it essentially leaves you with a nest, especially inside some of the source code files. You end up with a nest of ifdefs saying, okay, well, I know I have to do it this way if I'm on Solaris, or else if I'm on FreeBSD, I do it this way, etc. So what that leads to is a lot of code duplication, a lot of cut and paste, and a lot of bugs, actually. Because bugs can be fixed in one of the branches, say for Solaris, but neglected to be fixed in FreeBSD, even though it's essentially the same code. It's just using a few different APIs and interfaces. So Tridge went away, kind of disappeared. As I recall, it was for a few months, and essentially created the configure and make scripts for Samba, the AutoTools build, by hand. Now, this was before the AutoMake tools where you could get a template and it would build things for you. So we had all these little switches inside our big makefile, which was getting longer every year. And he basically took that and kept the entire functionality and converted it to AutoTools, which is what took him a couple of months, I think. But that actually changes the way you develop features and functionality in the code. Because you no longer say, oh, well, I know this works on FreeBSD. That's the thing I'm compiling on. You know, I'll just put this code in a big block of if def FreeBSD. What you would do now is you would essentially say, do I have this feature that AutoTools has detected for me? And if so, then I will code to that feature. And for platforms that don't have it, I will have to find some way of emulating it, but I'll try and keep the interfaces constant. And that ultimately turns into the libreplace infrastructure that we have today, which theoretically makes us a lot more portable and the code a lot more generic. The only thing that is still a mess beyond human comprehension is the quota system, which I still believe is probably inherited from those ugly days of the hand-configured makefile. People have tried to tidy it up, but it's one of those things that nobody really cares enough to do it right except for people who don't have any money, which is sort of universities, because they're the only people who care about disk prices, really. And so, you know, this is still one of the uglier pieces of Samba. Eventually, we ended up moving to WAF. I can talk about that. It's a Python-based build system, but we still maintain the auto-build system. There's a lot of arguments went on about that, and so we don't want to... I can talk about that later if I have a little more time. So the next really big change that came across us was essentially the rise of Linux. Back when we started Samba, Linux was a toy. There were many such source code available Unixes. There was a sort of a toy BSD. There was MKS Unix, I think. There was Minix. You know, none of them had any networking. So essentially, as far as for a network file server, they were unusable. Our main platform was Sonos, and then eventually started to become Solaris. But that all changed around the 2000s, and Linux just began to dominate up until the point where today, I'm sure Ira is looking at me with a very dissatisfied grin. It can be quite hard to build Samba on platforms other than sort of the Ubuntu of the week. We're trying to avoid that. We're trying to maintain some of the flexibility, but in practical terms, nobody cares about digital Unix, RX, or OSF1, or those things anymore. We even had a Cray Unicos port. Simply, people don't care about those platforms. They are dead. They are gone. And essentially, the Linux interfaces are, you know, we do have some Linux-specific interfaces now. So Samba now has per-thread credentials inside it using a Linux-only mechanism. I am requesting that the BSD folks and the Solaris folks put the same or put equivalent interfaces into their systems. But this is just one area where has anyone heard of Systemd, which is Leonard Pottering's? Yeah. So Systemd is Leonard Pottering's replacement for the init subsystem for Linux, but it is aggressively and proudly Linux only. It essentially makes no compromises for any other platform. It just says, I'm using Linux only interfaces. I'm using Linux only infrastructure. This is, you know, I am a Linux systemd, and that's all I'm ever going to be. And I'm trying to avoid Samba becoming something similar. Although with the complete domination of Linux in the server market that we live in, it's kind of hard to avoid. So, you know, do we go Linux becomes a new POSIX, or do we essentially try and fall back and degrade gracefully? You know, I'm sorry, Dave, I can't implement, you know, no change notification on your platform, and you know, and try and fall back to something a little more usable. We still haven't fixed that tension. That's probably going to get worse as time goes on. My guess is that probably in another 5 years, if we're still around, we will be Linux only. That's a horrible thing to say, but by that time, I think we'll have subsumed Linux. Will have subsumed all other Unixes, and really, that will be it.
Did you say we'll abandon 8-bit CPM?
Well, abandon 8-bit CPU. Well, you know, we may have people complaining that we don't run on Android, put it that way, because they will claim that that is Linux. So that's probably the pressures we'll get then. So in the very early days, when people were taking Samba and building building servers out of it that they would then deploy widely within their companies, we were very confused about whether we were actually a product. You know, should there be a Samba.com with me as CEO, goddammit, in the valley? Or should we just be a kit of parts that people create technologies from? And you know, we tried to do sort of product-style polish with some very bad results. I think SWOT is probably the worst of those.
Can we please never ever mention that again?
So if you're not on the Samba mailing list, Kai has respectfully requested we take SWOT out behind the bike shed and shoot it in the head.
Twice.
Yeah, and nobody has said no. So I think for 4.1, we're actually going to do that because it is purely a source of security holes, I believe, is the...
I have to confess culpability in being part of the
cause. Oh, okay, so the great thing is we have someone who has confessed. So all of our products, productization features are actually all John's fault. So maybe because he wanted to be the CEO of Samba.com. But what ended up happening was the OEMs, and I'm pointing out a couple there who are. Does anyone know what the bottom box is? Can anyone recognize that? Not you. You visited them. Okay, probably not. I actually worked for that company. They were called Whistle, and they produced a product called the Whistle Interjet, which was described in the trade press as the nicest server that you couldn't buy. Because they wanted to sell it via ISPs. They thought this was a great business model that ISPs were such wonderful salespeople that they would be able to sell boxes as well as internet service. And it turned out they couldn't sell either. So the other one up there was I wouldn't laugh, Amity, because IBM bought them. Okay. And a year later, terminated all the code and support contracts. So yes, more. Who's the fool now? So the other box up there at the top is the wonderful Cobalt Cube, which actually crushed us, because even though it had no user interface, it was purely Linux on a MIPS box, you know, shoveled out the door. It's cool. It's blue, and it had a glowing purple LED. What more could you possibly want from a server, you know? they were actually displayed in there was a very popular beer restaurant in Mountain View where they actually had one of those in the window as kind of a work of art with its little glowing. And at that point, I knew we were going to lose. So the OEMs essentially made it very clear to us, we don't care about your productizations, they suck anyway. We're going to have to do our own, so please just become a kit of parts that we can build things out of. And I think that's what we'll become, which is sort of lower key than you know that we used to be. I think Apache still has the name of a brand, whereas we became part of the plumbing, you know, sort of more of an Armitage Shanks sort of toilet type stuff than the house itself. We still need to work on modularity to make it easier for the OEMs to build things. Please feel free to chip in with any questions or comments throughout the talk, by the way. So around that time, we were hitting a wall in our development efforts. Some would say we still have, but we started being caught in our own complexity. So there were multiple Windows clients and variants out there. Windows 2000 was just coming out. There were Mac clients. DOS and Windows 9X were still around. Windows NT was still around. And almost every time we fixed a bug, we would break something else. So for a while, the Samba releases were sort of bumping along the floor quality-wise, because it was very hard to understand what it was we were doing wrong. We were fixing something, and you know, even testing the fix wouldn't help. Because you know, you would test the fix against the bug that you had the test case for, and it would, yeah, that would be great, that would fix it. And then a week later, someone would say, well, you broke my authentication. You know, and that was, without having a proper test suite, that was just very, very hard to fix. And we had no way of realizing what we'd broken. And we weren't doing well at that point. So at this point, we moved to actual, you know, and there's Mets exploring a light socket, I think, as a young child. So we really had to adopt modern techniques. You know, and I'm sure many of the proprietary companies were there ahead of us, but I think we do very, very well in terms of our test infrastructure now. What really broke it, what really made, and this again was a strategic decision, what really sort of broke the mold of what we were doing was trying to get the DOS wildcard matching algorithm correct. I hate to tell you this, Tom, but the doc, the algorithm in the doc, and Chris isn't here, so I can't blame him, is still incorrect. I've never submitted a bug to DocHelp because it only affects DOS clients, and no DOS clients, no applications that are in any use anymore ever use any of these features. But we could never, and still have never been able to work out exactly the algorithm for that. And I believe that the only way you could do so would be to go into the DOS code and actually walk through it step by step. And I don't believe anyone wants to do that. And you know, we're. It's the rename. I believe it's the unlink and rename. Yes, wildcard unlink and rename. And you can see how good our relationship is now that we've never asked you to do it. Because that is something above and beyond the call of duty. We could never make that work. And so essentially at that point, Trisha, this is not scaling, not working, created something called GenTest, which was a program that would randomize tests against two servers. That was the genesis of it. We started using our SMB client tool to build a test-driven infrastructure tool. We're now at the point, which I'm really, really happy about. It takes a long time to put a commit into the build, but you have to. Every commit that goes into our build now has to pass the full suite of regression tests. And you know, every time we add a feature or something new, we have to add tests. Or the goal is, I'm not saying we're 100% correct on this, but we aim to add tests to cover every new piece of code or every feature that we're adding in there. And right now, what we do is we only modify things if we have proof, and it can be sometimes as little as a network capture trace, but we have proof that Windows behaves that way. And the bugs that we still have are usually us being caught by our own legacy code. So the share level authentication that you know we tried to do and these are things that Windows never did, and these are our own particular hell bugs that were our own legacy systems that we're trying to keep working. So getting a good infrastructure is really important. And Cernet runs ours. I think they do an excellent job of this. Later projects that, when we started, there was no shared infrastructure that you could leverage, like SourceForge or GitHub or anything like that. So you know, we ended up having to build our own. But Bugzilla, I think, is one of our most important systems. It really is the collective memory of everything we've ever gotten wrong. And we're getting much, much better about keeping regressions in there, keeping test cases in there. We haven't hit the 10,000 bug mark yet. But I'm looking forward to the day when we have to go to 64-bit bug IDs. That was, I remember that was when I was working for Sun, that was always noted as the hallmark of quality, Solaris-ish, when you have to use greater than 32-bit bug IDs. So you know, we're still a little better than that, but it's a very important tool. And I'm still CC'd, I think Volker is too, on every single entry to Bugzilla. So we do get, and CMO too. We get a lot of mail, but to find out what's actually going on, it gives you an idea of the relative quality of a release. If you get a flood of bugs coming in after a particular release has gone out, you know you screwed it up. You know, even if it's just people misunderstanding things. I better hurry up. So the build farm is something that is becoming less important now that Linux is starting to dominate. But it allowed us to test Samba portability to platforms that were just not in common use. So it allowed people to download some code and run it as a non-privileged user. This would mean that people in various companies, universities with weird systems could download, build the Samba code, and then essentially upload the results back in a form that we could then look at. And it would give us feedback as one of the useful things that it used to do, these days not so much, is it allowed us access to the Silicon Graphics IRIX compiler, which was a very, very good, very clean 64-bit compiler, and actually gave us a lot of bug reports that tidied up the code. Like I say, now that Linux is the 800-pound gorilla, it's not as widely used, but it was a very important step on the way for development. And then we managed to look out, mainly because we were well-known enough that we were chosen by a proprietary vendor called Coverity. Has anyone heard of Coverity? Oh, good. So the people at the back, if you haven't heard of it, if you ever do any code development, it's very well worth looking at, although it's one of those tools where if you have to ask how much it is, you can't afford it. What it does is it's a static analyzer. It will go through code paths, and it will provably find bugs. Now, we're very lucky. When this first came out, we had about 250, 300 bugs. And Volker and I and a few others jumped on them, and we basically nailed it down to about zero. And of course, every time we do a new release, the bug count goes up again, and we have to run around getting it down. The analyzer was very good. The interesting thing for a while was that they used us as a testing ground to test their analyzer because they were running into Tridge code, which sometimes was completely provably correct, but confused their analyzer greatly. But it cleaned up an amazing amount of the code. Now, this is mostly code that you would never see executed, because it was things like memory leaks on error code paths, indirection into null pointers in error code paths. So these are things that you would not normally see happen. But every one of those is a potential disaster waiting to happen. If you can force code down an error path that it's not expecting to go, and you can cause it to indirect through a bad pointer, it's potentially a security problem. Now, we've never found a security problem through Coverity, but it's still an extremely good tool. And they do periodically update their scans, and it's still a very... I think we won some kind of award for the project that fixed the most bugs the quickest, or we got some kind of Ring Zero quality award or something from them, which... Oh, yes, possibly, yeah. I denial of service, is that a security bug? I'm not sure. Yes, they are extremely helpful on that. They do keep our code quality high. So then the Microsoft documentation came about, and the genie on there does look a little bit like Chris Hertel, at least has the same beard. That's kind of not a coincidence. And so there was a magic box that would answer any questions. And initially it was like, oh no, what are we going to do now? You know, what are we going to do at the weekends now? Everything we want to know is all there. And so we were buried under boxes and boxes of documentation for a while. But what really cheered me up was the realization that the Oracle of doc help wasn't 100% correct. This is great, because an imperfect Oracle is no better than no Oracle at all. What it means is you still have to write tests that run against Windows, right? I'm not trying to be negative here. It's maintaining the fun and interest. The fact that we can still find bugs in the docs, and you know, we help everybody by submitting bugs back to the docs, and then the docs get pushed out to everybody, and you know, everybody wins. But essentially, we were frightened for a while it would mean that our tests would become obsolete because everyone would know everything. But it turns out that protocols as complex as this aren't so easy to fully document. And so the test-driven development that we do, essentially running against Windows first and then deciding that that's the correct correct way to behave, is still a very important to us. So Carol is, yes, Carolyn. Well done, Carol. I don't know whether anyone knows Carolyn, but Carolyn is sat there at the back, and she is our release manager. She deserves a round of applause. Let's, yay! So I passed on the release managership to Jerry Carter. Jerry passed it on to Carolyn, and Carolyn finally really formalized our release process in a way that I just think has massively improved the quality of what we do. So what happened was the release branches, for a while, you know, you could still check into a release branch if it was a bug that you thought was urgent enough and you advocated it for it on the team lists or whatever, you could still check things in. And the occasional disaster happened that way. You know, occasionally we would avoid disasters, but we would also have disasters. And so finally, Carolyn came along and essentially said, no one is checking into this branch but me. You can check into your the test branch, and everybody will test out of that. But to actually go out the door, there's a formal process. So now bug reports are required for any change that goes into the release branch. So we have to have a Bugzilla report. So there's always a record of what we did and why we did it. Two Samba team engineers have to sign off. I mean, this is a bit of a pain if you're an external contributor. It means that you have to get two people to bother to look at the patch, but it's the only way that we're able to maintain the level of quality that we have. Preferably, any bug has to have a regression test attached to it, or at least some way of testing to see that we don't regress in the future. And so Carolyn has given us basically reliable, stable, and timely releases. And I think this has been a massive improvement in our QA process. And the great thing about that is it means that the OEMs, who are essentially our bread and butter, can depend on us in a way. In some ways this is good because they really depend on us. In some way that's very bad because a lot of them just get very lazy and they'll ship whatever we give them because it's like, well, if they put it out of release, it must be good. So sometimes we don't get as much QA from external OEMs as we would like because they tend to trust what we do. But I'm still glad that we have a very, very reliable release process. So talking about OEMs and adoption of Samba, stability of what you ship to them really, really matters. And the main places where OEMs customize Samba is the VFS, the virtual file system switch that we have inside Samba. And I think it was around 3.4, I'm sure someone will correct me if I'm wrong, that we really decided, hey, we're just changing this too much. What we must do is at least for a major, 3 or 4.x release, we cannot make any changes. So you can make changes to the VFS before a major release, but once a release has come out, the VFS must essentially be frozen so that you don't surprise OEMs who have built and tested VFS modules and tools around the interface. You don't screw it up. Now, it turns out that's harder than it looks because the VFS interface has never been properly and formally defined, and this is something we're moving towards and getting better at, and Richard Sharp there in the corner is doing a very good job of that. So we're trying to draw a line around the boundaries of the API so that people know what is part of the VFS, what we can change and what we can't. The problem is other areas of Samba, other structures in Samba do tend to bleed into the VFS in a certain way. And I think Metz and Michael did a great job in moving most of those structures into a VFS header file that OEMs actually know that they can kind of depend on. And I think the VFS and the ease of use of it is one of the reasons that we're still as actively developed and used as we are. Okay, I'm kind of running out of time. I don't think I've got that many slides. I am the last talk as well, but you can boo me off stage when you're tired. So Jerry, who's the release manager, looked at all the different distributed version control systems. And he was a great advocate of going to distributed version control. because he wanted to break the idea that we had a master Samba repository and that was the one that everybody trusted. It turned out it didn't work that way. We didn't break the dependency on that. But he did make a very good choice of Git as the next generation source code control system. And Git really is the winner in the distributed version control system contest. I mean, all the others are essentially stillborn now. So the goal was that everybody's Git tree would be as good as anyone else's. There would be no Samba, central Samba repository. People would sort of mail Git references around, and you could pull from anyone. Practically, we use it as a glorified CVS or SVN. This is the getting booed off stage. The claim is that everybody else uses it this way. Practically, that's not true. Yes, Ira, comment. Yes.
And Linus's tree.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I'm saying in that we use it as SVN. Now, don't get me wrong, I still have branches. I just do it by having different repositories, which may be a little weird as far as Git comes along, but I have the great advantage that the Git maintainer actually works in the office next door to me in Google, so... I can go and shout at him whenever I don't understand anything. And Git is not a very easy thing to understand. Anyway, so there are some associated tools like Gerrit and some code review tools. Because Git is also, I'm sure I'm not giving away any secrets, but Git is incredibly widely used within Google. And so there are many code review tools that are built into Google infrastructure that use Git. And I'm hoping that As we get more comfortable with doing code reviews, we'll end up moving to a more formal infrastructure for that. Right now, we're still just kind of using mailing lists, and that seems to be okay. But yeah, all right, maybe we could scale better there. So this is where we're getting into the modern era. So one of the interesting things about being used widely by OEMs is, and especially IBM, is that at some point the lawyers come to you and say, prove to us you have the rights to ship that code. Prove that that's yours. And that's why having a source code control system is very useful, of course, but even so, there are the occasional disasters with copyrights from people who are dead, disappeared, you know, contributed under a Mickey Mouse name or whatever. You don't know where they came from. And the typical California contract basically says that they own every bowel movement that you emit while you work for the company. And so it's hard for people to submit code without actually getting blessing from their company. And so OEMs were starting to worry that Samba might not be completely legal. Samba team members were finding it difficult when they moved jobs and wanted to work on Samba. So the comment is basically corporations are utter bastards that steal stuff at will. But that doesn't mean to say that we should have the same morals. We should be better than that.
I'm just surprised that CEO comes to you or to somebody in the boss and they say, OK, show that you have the
ownership
of this.
So what you have to remember is that, you know, the attorneys and whatever who work for corporations, they have no sense of humor, no morals, and no idea that they are... I mean, whatever they want is the most important thing in the world. You know, they can be violating your rights up the wazoo, and they'll still come to you and say, hey, claim you have the rights to ship that code that we stole from you. You know? They would see no conflict in that. That's like, hey, we legitimately stole that code and we want to ship it legally and you know, prove to us you have the rights to, you know, that we want to violate. So one of the things that we did was implement essentially a form where a developer can assert on the mailing list, yes, I work for so-and-so, and I have the rights to submit. And it's a very, very simple form. And I'm very happy about that. That does mean, essentially, that we can now... The other reason we can accept corporate copyright is a long story about GPL versions, which I'm not going to go into. I think I've told before. But essentially, now that we have the GPL v3, this is another reason that GPL v3 is a much, much better license for free software, is there's no longer the fear of the GPL death penalty. So the GPL v3 means that corporations can violate, make mistakes, and they can come back into compliance without losing all their rights. And this actually makes it a lot easier for people to use it and to contribute code under GPL v3 licenses. So, you know, the one thing that we should do is everyone who's written some code that they're claiming is theirs, they need to have a signed off by line in the commit. Now, some team members, and I'm not going to mention names, are not using this correctly, but the goal is you have signed off by, that's the person that wrote it, and then you have reviewed by, and that's, you know, the person who actually did the review. And if it's an external contribution, then the external contributor has the signed off by line and the team members have the two reviews in there. Anyway, so that's my... probably should have brought that up at the team meeting rather than here, but I couldn't kind of resist it. So in keeping with my grand tradition of losing every single vote that I've ever called for on the Samba team mailing list, I was motivated by someone who is now no longer in the room, who thought it was a great idea but didn't want to propose it himself, that we should move to review-driven development. And so I proposed it, and of course everyone went up in arms and said, this will destroy our development process. We can't possibly do this. It will slow us down. But we seem to be doing it. So the comment is we only ship half the number of patches we used to ship, but is the quality better? That's the point. If you're going two steps forward, one step back, not taking the one step back, losing half of those patches is probably quite good. Yes. Yeah, I would say not. There are still a large number of patches going in. It does take a little more time for them to get to be reviewed. But I think, again, as we go along, we are raising the bar. We are trying to remain competitive with the best practices as applied by corporate development. And I think we can do this. It may be a little more inconvenient. It may be a little more processed than we're used to. But remember, we're a more mature project. We don't have that many more developers, but we need to follow the best practices in the industry. And right now, having mandatory code review is really the way to go. I've seen the difference in quality that you get in Google by having mandatory code review, and nobody there would go back. Nobody there would go back to not doing that. I don't think it slowed us down that much. Yes, Kai. In my view, it hasn't slowed us down that much. Your patch, which you posted today, got reviewed in about 30 minutes, I believe, and was applied into the tree. So yes, it slowed you down terribly. I'm sure it used to be 15 minutes before you got it in. Anyway, this is something that Volker came up with. I really like. I would like. We're kind of pushing more people to do this. It's essential, and Metz is also, I know, a big advocate of this, essentially the micro-patch revolution. So, I mean, Volker was the first person who really started to articulate this. And so what I tend to do these days is if I'm doing a big, ugly change that I don't really understand, I will actually spend a bunch of time, I'll write the patch, I'll do it in a branch, I'll take some steps forward, some steps back, and I'll end up with a massive change set that is impossible to review. So what I will then do is I will go back and try and break it into a series of very small commits, each one of which changes one set of functionality. Now, the gold standard is to keep the regression test build working across every single step of the patch. That's not always possible to achieve. But what I find, at least when I'm doing this, is it makes me really think about the changes that I'm making a lot more than I used to. Before, it was very easy to sort of whack in a great chunk of code, get it all working. You know, it's like, okay, I've written my regression test. It works. You know, why are these reviewers complaining? It's obviously perfect. It obviously works. Just stick it in there, goddammit. Look, I even have a test. But, you know... Yeah, what? In the micro...
Wine as well.
Sorry, there? Wine's weird though, because they have the one single gatekeeper. So, but anyway, this I think again this is a much better way of creating code, a much better way of creating patches, and I'm hoping that we will all eventually move towards this. Yes. 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 Well, that sucks and it's broken. Yeah. That's why this makes it workable. Yes. Hey, that's great. We're ahead of Juniper. Woo! Sorry. Sorry. we're ahead of industry best practice. Sorry. I'm sure there are places in Google that don't do that too. The only problem with it is you have to have a very, very detail-oriented mind to make this work. But it really is very, very good idea for creating good patches. So I'm going to try and hurry up. Other things, okay, yeah, I know, I'm way over time. Other things that have improved the code quality, there's a particularly malevolent set of techniques called fuzzing, and there's a company that's local to me in California called Codenomica, and again, wonderful tool. If you have to ask how much it is, you can't afford it. It attacks network protocols over the wire because it understands. I'm hurrying up. I'm hurrying, honestly. Anyway, they've never found a bug yet. Well, let's just come in here and listen. I'm still talking. They haven't found a bug yet. But they're very kindly willing to run their product against us on a regular basis. The first time they did so was devastating. They absolutely blew us to bits. Many, many crashes. So it's an incredibly valuable tool, even in code that we thought was rock solid. I think Volker and the IBM guys have already talked about scale out and Swift test, so I'll go over there. There's a discussion on whether we should what we should do for libraries, whether we should move CTD back into the main code base. Let's have that discussion later, maybe at the panel discussion, so I'm going to skip over that one. So what are the remaining challenges? Now, I'm wrapping up, because I got some nice pictures at the end. So firstly, what are our problems? Samba is now too big. There's no one person who understands all of Samba. I think that's probably true of all really large code bases, but it scares me, and it scares me because I used to understand all of Samba. So I don't like to move to the point where there's areas of the code. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not frightened to mess with any area of the code. There's no area I won't trample on and mess up. But, you know, there are areas now that I think, I don't really know what I'm doing here, which is worrying. So, you know, another issue that we have, I had to use this because let's be honest, I'm the Tron guy and Thomas Pfennig is the BSD guy. I mean, let's face it, but here we are. I'm not saying anything silly like Windows is going to go away, but what I am saying is that how many of the team members here actually run Windows on a day-to-day basis for anything other than testing Samba? I don't count testing Samba. You weirdo. Okay, so we have one, well, you're not reporting enough bugs then. Yeah, he works for Dell. He's kind of required to. But most of the people doing full-time development, Richard may be the exception, we don't use Windows for anything anymore. And we used to depend on it as part of our job, and that was essentially why Samba was created. So again, that's something that worries me. We have way too many internal linkages. It would be really nice to split off some of that big maul of mud and have nice, clean interfaces between separate pieces of code. I think that's where we're in terms of industry best practices, we're falling down there. That would be a much cleaner place to develop. Scaling up and down, and there's Met standing in front of one of Cernet's server farms, I believe. You know, we need to keep it running on incredibly small systems like Kai's Raspberry Pi, as well as, you know, the largest scale-out systems that we can. And getting the same code base to do that is hard. And again, it's easy to make a fix that works on the big systems and completely screws up the small, or vice versa. So getting coverage on all those systems is something that we really need. And finally, cloud storage. I mean, you know, it's still a cloud, man. That's what it's doing to what we do. I mean, we need to remain relevant. So is our future to be a gateway into cloud storage? We haven't figured that out yet. So this again is something that we have to think about, and is one of the things that keeps me up at night. So I'm way over time, and I don't care. So any questions and comments?